Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to start with the Royals today, and then we're going to move on to the Hollywood section. There's some current events, and our current events are sort of piggybacking with our politics section too. So we might end up in the politics section a little bit earlier than normal. So let's start with our first article about the Royals. Kate Middleton interrupts her vacation for a project close to her heart. On Wednesday, the Princess of Wales launched a series of 7 new educational videos with the Royal Foundation Center for Early Childhood. This is by Olivia Batul on August 6th. Kate Middleton has a very full agenda. Even on vacation, the Princess of Wales never forgets to pursue her commitments. This Wednesday, August 6th, under the aegis of her Royal Foundation, the Center for Early Childhood, the wife of Prince William launched a series of 7 educational videos designed to help children develop in a healthy environment. Early childhood is recognized as a golden opportunity to build strong foundations for a healthy and happy future life, Princess Kate explained in a statement. The Center of Early Childhood's new animated films show how adults can create caring and loving interactions with children, helping to foster their social and emotional development from their earliest years. Kate, a mother of 3, was keen to be part of her foundation's project by getting involved in the creation of the short films. To this end, she spent time with 2 illustrators and with early childhood professionals who also contributed their expertise to the development of the project. The series, available on YouTube in English, has also been translated into Welsh and British Sign Language. The 7 animated films offer a wide range of learning opportunities that encourage early childhood professionals to rethink their interactions with toddlers. On the program, learning to listen to a child's emotional state, helping them to manage it, understanding how to adapt to their pace and learning abilities. The Center of Early Childhood was founded in 2021 in line with Princess Kate's royal and humanitarian commitment. Today, with this audiovisual project, the association can count on 25 organizations committed to using its series in their work by integrating it into training courses or sharing them within their networks. Next up, King Charles is now selling dog treats. The monarch's latest offerings are hand-baked in the kitchens at Balmoral for your 4-legged prince or princess. This is by Blanche Marcel on August 5th. King Charles is starting a new business for dogs. It's almost a given. The Windsor family's love of 4-legged companions has been passed down from generation to generation, and dogs have always held a special place in the palace. So, the monarch has decided to give them the best of everything, with a range of treats worthy of the name. According to The Telegraph, the treats are made of wholemeal flour, eggs, and chicken broth, then hand-baked in the kitchens of Balmoral Castle, the king's Scottish residence in the Highlands. The castle's official website lists a retail price of £5 for 75 grams, around $6.64. These 100% natural cookies, hand-baked in the kitchens of Balmoral Castle, have been lovingly prepared in small batches for your 4-legged prince or princess, it reads. But that's not all. The dogs are also entitled to a royal wardrobe. Also for sale, a tweed collar for £32, or $42.49, a matching lead for £40, or $53.11, a small treat bag, again in tweed, and a bowl decorated with the royal coat of arms, sold for £28, or $37.17. The highlight of the collection? A coat in the famous tartan check pattern called Happy Hound, designed by the king himself and available at the Sandringham Estate Boutique, priced at $44.99 or $59.74. So you see, Charles is a tweed lover. The monarch, like his wife, Queen Camilla, has a special affection for dogs. Earlier this year, the couple sadly announced the death of Beth, the queen's beloved Jack Russell. Since then, they've adopted a new puppy, Molly, from the Battersea Dogs and Cats Home Shelter. A touching snapshot published on May 18th showed Camilla holding the little dog in her arms. Charles, too, has fallen in love. He recently adopted a Legato Romanolo, an Italian dog specialized in truffle hunting, whom he named Snuff. It's the first dog he's personally owned in about two decades. In the 1980s, Charles adopted Tigga, another Jack Russell, shortly after his marriage to Princess Diana. The dog died in 2002, aged 18, but his love of pets never left him. With these new treats, Charles is making a new declaration to them. Moving into some current events from the week, a Hamptons mystery. Irish entrepreneur found dead at Montauk Yacht Club. Homicide detectives continue to investigate the Hamptons death of 33-year-old clothing company founder Martha Nolan O'Slaterra. This is by Eve Beatty on August 10th. 6 days after a woman was found unresponsive inside a Hamptons yacht, investigators are still working to determine how and why she died. It's an incident that's roiled the Tony Summer Getaway area, where crime is low but certainly not non-existent, especially as the deceased, 33-year-old Martha Nolan O'Slaterra, was familiar to many as the owner of a pop-up boutique just steps from a high-traffic luxury hotel. According to the Suffolk County Police Department, a 911 call placed around midnight Tuesday reported that a woman had fallen unconscious on a yacht moored at the 200-slip marina of the Montauk Yacht Club, a 16-acre Hamptons resort that served area residents, barring breaks for renovations, since 1928. The male caller, who has not been publicly identified, told dispatchers that Good Samaritans had performed CPR on the woman, who was later identified as Nolan O'Slaterra, to no avail. First responders pronounced her dead at the scene. A preliminary homicide investigation and exam was inconclusive regarding the cause of death, police say. According to the Suffolk County Office of the Medical Examiner, an autopsy on Nolan O'Slaterra's remains performed later in the week did not show evidence of violence. Her final cause of death remains unknown, pending further examination. It's unclear who owns the yacht Nolan O'Slaterra died on, which CBS reports was a 50 to 60-foot vessel docked off Star Island Road. When contacted with a request for additional details, a spokesperson for the Montauk Yacht Club provided a written statement that reads, "We are saddened to learn of the tragic incident that took place. Our team is cooperating with law enforcement in their ongoing investigation and remains committed to the safety and well-being of our guests and staff. We have no further comment at this time." While the Hamptons have their own unique set of problems, unexplained deaths are exceedingly rare. The 2001 slaying of financier Ted Ammon is enough of an outlier that it remains a topic of discussion today. A more common true crime tale for the region might be allegations of financial impropriety at a wealthy denizen's day job. That's why Nolan O'Slaterra case has attracted so much attention, that and her visibility as the owner of a summertime pop-up shop at Gurney's Montauk Resort and Seawater Spa, which began in 1926 as a quaint 20-room hotel but has evolved into a massive spa and hospitality complex. In fact, Gurney's also owned the Montauk Yacht Club from 2018 until 2022, when it was sold to boating network Safe Harbor Marinas for $149.4 million. Born in the Irish town of Carlow, Nolan O'Slaterra moved to New York about 10 years ago, reports the Irish Independent. The Manhattan resident had filed for divorce from husband Sam Ryan earlier this year, according to Irish newspaper Sunday World, and was currently in a relationship with another man, the Independent reports, who is understood not to have been on the boat with her at the time of her death. According to the paper, she'd messaged him earlier in the evening to say that she'd Uber home by 1 a.m. She had told him she was meeting someone in connection with her business, Sunday World writes. That makes the circumstances detailed by the longstanding local news outlet 27 East all the more perplexing. According to the publication, witnesses at the marina say a naked man running down the dock shouting, do something," preceded the 911 call Tuesday. The man, whom the outlet reports owns two vessels currently docked at the marina, reportedly even threw a tube of sunscreen at a neighboring ship in an effort to rouse someone to help. Suffolk County police were not available to confirm those details of public time. In recent years, Nolan Oslatara had launched a clothing and accessories company called East by East, which sold its wares online, and as of July, at an outdoor pop-up shop at Gurney's, a post by Nolan Oslatara on TikTok notes, "Goals achieved," Nolan Oslatara captioned her announcement of the shop's launch. Via statement, Gurney's says, "We are deeply saddened by the tragic news regarding Martha Nolan and extend our sincere condolences to her family and loved ones. While Martha was not an employee of Gurney's, we were proud to host her East by East pop-up and admired her entrepreneurial spirit and creative vision." According to the Irish Times, the boat Nolan Oslatara died on, which is called Ripple, remains at the yacht club's main dock. Meanwhile, Nolan Oslatara's remains are in Suffolk County custody as final post-mortem testing, including toxicology and other reports, is completed. Final results from that analysis are expected to take at least 3 months. Next up is a healthcare check. "I'm fine," Francis Ford Coppola reassures after heart surgery in Italy. The Godfather director recently underwent scheduled heart surgery in Rome. This is by Blanche Mercel on August 6th. Francis Ford Coppola spent much of 2024, as well as a good deal of 2025, crisscrossing the globe in support of his ambitious film, Megalopolis. It was an impressive mobilization for an 86-year-old man who more recently took advantage of a stay in Italy to take care of his health. This summer, Coppola was hospitalized in Rome to have a heart implant replaced under the supervision of Dr. Andrea Natale, a renowned cardiologist who has been treating the director for over 30 years. On Instagram, the filmmaker reassured his fans, "Dada, what my kids call me, is fine. Taking an opportunity while in Rome to do the update of my 30-year-old AFib procedure with its inventor, a great Italian doctor, Dr. Andrea Natale. I am well." Rest, it seems, is out of the question. Coppola is already working on a new project. Earlier this summer, he was in Calabria scouting out locations for the film. Few details have been revealed, other than that the director intends to highlight the wonders of the region. "Calabria is a region well known for its mafia, but I'm not interested in that. My film will focus solely on the beauties of this region," he told the local press. Despite a lukewarm reception for Megalopolis, including Coppola's winning the unflattering title of Worst Director at the recent Golden Raspberry Awards, the icon doesn't seem to be hanging up his boots. On Friday, August 1st, he rounded off a six-city U.S. tour with a screening of the film, followed by a Q&A session in San Francisco. Like Clint Eastwood, who at 95 is still making films, Francis Ford Coppola seems to be driven by an undiminished passion. Can the father of The Godfather still surprise us even now? Only time will tell. This next article piggybacks politics, but Elon Musk faces another rough week with total chaos at his new restaurant, a landmark $240 million judgment against Tesla, and claims that his waste-cutting government agency costs taxpayers billions. The world's richest man can't seem to buy happiness. This is by Eve Beatty on August 2nd. If having children improves happiness as much as some studies suggest, it seems like Elon Musk, with his 14, at least, kids, should be over the moon. The Tesla CEO, freed from his doubtlessly tiresome day-to-day relationship with President Donald Trump, can turn his attention back to the businesses he runs, albeit with that time for a new political party that actually cares about the people side hustle. But though he's out of the White House and back in the boardroom, at least two of his high-profile business efforts are facing headwinds this week. Let's begin with his electric car company, which has been in a tailspin since at least early 2025. Its business has been faced with a dramatically softening market for EVs, a situation that was certainly not helped by the removal of EV purchase tax credits in Trump's controversial spending bill. Additionally, the demographics of EV drivers tend to lean liberal and left, while Musk has publicly reddened over the years, resulting in many prospective Tesla buyers to seek another brand. And on Friday, the company suffered another blow. After a four-year-long civil suit, a Miami jury ruled that Tesla was at least partially responsible for a fatal 2019 crash. A federal jury agreed that his Tesla's autopilot driver assist function was engaged during the collision with a parked vehicle. A technology failure bears some of the blame for the wreck, which killed 22-year-old Nibal Benavides Leon and seriously injured Dylan Angulo, both of whom were standing near the crash site. Elon Musk's company must pay victims $243 million, the jury ruled, though it's unlikely that that's the final figure Tesla will pay. In a statement, Tesla announced, "Today's verdict is wrong," and confirmed that it would appeal the judgment. But even if they fail to overturn the decision, a pre-trial agreement would cap Tesla's responsibility at $172 million. This is the first such decision against Tesla, but it's expected to open the floodgates, personal injury lawyer Miguel Custodio tells NPR. It will embolden a lot of people to come to court. A lot of people have been visiting Musk's Tesla Diner, which opened in Los Angeles last month. Maybe too many people, as based on a diner's account posted to social media, the overall vibe was total chaos. In addition to glitching robots, a patron injured by a patio covering and claims that living next to it is absolute hell, TikTok user Let's Go says her visit was one of the worst food experiences of my life, citing a broken order app and hour-plus waits for a burger. The interior of the diner is cool, very sleek and futuristic, Let's Go says, but the overall vibe was total chaos. Orders were late, food was coming out cold, staff seemed overwhelmed, and mistakes were constant. Musk's polarizing character means that social media will likely be the best place to find consumer reviews of the business, as its Yelp page is currently disabled due to content related to media reports. It's unlikely that it will change anytime soon. Reviews probably don't matter much in this case, as no one, not even Elon Musk, goes into the present-day restaurant business to get rich. But Musk's promise to help America save money is also under scrutiny this week, as a report from the minority staff of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations released this week says that in the first 6 months of the year, Musk's much-trumpeted DOGE cost-cutting department, it actually generated some $21.7 billion in waste, reports the Daily Beast. Highlights of the report include an estimated $14.8 billion spent to pay certain federal employees not to work, $263 million related to Department of Energy loan freezes, and perhaps to note to any with micromanaging bosses out there, $155 million in wasted time costs related to those weekly emails federal workers were required to send outlining five accomplishments. If Musk required such an email from himself this week, it seems like coming up with those five bullets would be a tough task indeed. Our next article is part of the Epstein saga. Ghislaine Maxwell's lawyer to Vanity Fair, "I love representing the underdog." David Oscar Marcus, the cheerful criminal defense attorney and one-time Alan Dershowitz mentee, speaks to Vanity Fair about the Jeffrey Epstein case. This is by Dan Adler on August 7th. For 2 days last month, Ghislaine Maxwell, one of her lawyers and a top Justice Department official, met in a Tallahassee courthouse. Backlash over the Trump administration's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files was cresting. The private interview did little to quell the increasingly prevalent idea that an unholy bargain between the president and Maxwell was being struck in plain sight. Her assistance to former Epstein friend Donald Trump in exchange for her freedom, or something closer to it. As Maxwell's attorney, David Oscar Marcus, explains it to Vanity Fair, cheerfully apologizing for not being able to say more, there's no cause for concern. Even after his client's recent move to a lower security facility, a change confirmed on Friday, and even as Trump waxes freely about his pardon power. "I wish I could respond to those critics," the Miami-based lawyer tells me, "but we're just not going to comment on that." In his representation of Maxwell, Marcus is stuck with the argument her lawyers have made since she was indicted toward the end of Trump's first term. "I'm convinced she never would have been charged had Epstein not died in prison," he insists. "They needed somebody in that chair, and she was the next person up." As the White House seeks to tamp down the furor it has faced since the announcement that no further information on Epstein would be released, it is largely shifting focus toward Maxwell. ABC News reported on Tuesday that the Trump administration is considering releasing transcripts of Maxwell's DOJ interview and that nothing from the exchange would implicate Trump. The interview was conducted by Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who served as Trump's lead defense attorney during his hush money trial last year and is counted as a friend by Marcus. Blanche was the first two-time guest on Marcus's podcast for the defense. The Deputy Attorney General is seeking the truth, Marcus told reporters after the meeting. He asked every possible question, and he's doing an amazing job. In front of the cameras, he looked comfortable but unflashy, at least as far as defense lawyers go, more likely to be seen carrying a backpack into court than wearing a double-breasted suit. Despite his silence on some of the particulars, Marcus has been waging Maxwell's battle on social media and in the press. Thanks, at Rep. James Comer, he wrote on X after the House Oversight Chair announced that the committee was subpoenaing his client. Respectfully, here is our response. In addition to making efforts to secure a pardon, Maxwell is appealing her child sex trafficking conviction on the basis that Epstein's notorious 2007 non-prosecution agreement should have shielded her as a co-conspirator. President Trump built his legacy in part on the power of a deal, Marcus wrote in a statement last month. We are appealing to not only the Supreme Court, but to the president himself to recognize how profoundly unjust it is to scapegoat Ghislaine Maxwell for Epstein's crimes, especially when the government promised she would not be prosecuted. Maxwell's family has also been circulating talking points developed on its advocacy site, realghislaine.com. Playing offense online as well as in court has lately become a more regular strategy in high-profile criminal matters, with lawyers for Karen Reed and Sean Diddy Combs doing as much. Combs' attorney, Tenny Garagos, who defended the mogul on TikTok in the lead-up to his sex trafficking and racketeering trial in May, is slated to appear on Marcus's podcast soon. Combs was acquitted on the most serious charges he faced, but convicted on two prostitution counts. Look at what happened with Senator Bob Menendez with the gold bar pictures in the indictment, Marcus says. Defense lawyers have to be permitted to combat that in the media. Otherwise, you can't get a fair shake with not just the court of public opinion, but with jurors. Marcus's father practiced law in Miami for more than 50 years. And as a child, Marcus took a liking to the criminal side of the field and the action that came with it. I love representing the underdog, fighting the bully, he says. I could never be a prosecutor. I could never put people in cages. He was mentored at Harvard Law School by Alan Dershowitz before the attorney had his own entanglement with the broader Epstein saga. Maxwell knows everything, Dershowitz recently said in a Fox News interview. She is the Rosetta Stone. Marcus's clients in Florida have ranged from former Tallahassee mayor Andrew Gillum to one of the Colombian brothers who founded the Cali cartel, for a time the world's leading cocaine supplier. That was one of my biggest regret cases, he says. Not that I took the case, but that we didn't go to trial. The Rodriguez Orihuela brothers cut a deal in 2006 with Alex Acosta, the same federal prosecutor who struck the agreement with Epstein that continues to reverberate nearly two decades later. Now, one of the least sympathetic characters in American life has received a few hints of support on the right, with Newsmax host Greg Kelly recently noting that Maxwell is in jail right now for like 40 years or something crazy. In Marcus's case, it didn't take any work to find the good in her. That's going to strike a lot of people as odd, and people are going to raise their eyebrows at it, he says, but those people couldn't be criminal defense lawyers. All right, our next article is going to pivot us into the politics section. South Park has been pissing viewers off for decades. Then it came for Trump. The show has a history of controversy and provocation, but it's still virtually impossible to know where Trey Parker and Matt Stone really stand. This is by David Canfield on August 6th. In the 28 years since South Park premiered, hundreds of its TV comedy peers have come and gone. But even the ones with similar longevity don't have South Park's continued impact. Comedy Central's foul-mouthed animated sitcom affirmed this again last month when it abruptly returned to air after a bitter streaming rights renegotiation that got wrapped up in the elongated closing of the merger between Skydance Media and the show's parent company, Paramount. The season premiere, Sermons on the Mount, debuted within 24 hours of creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone publicly signing a five-year, $1.5 billion deal with Paramount. The episode also called out the company directly and sharply, ripped into the recent cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and went after President Donald Trump like the show never had before. South Park recast Trump as Satan's jealous, disingenuous, delusional lover, a new spin on the show's old take on Saddam Hussein, a character that most famously headlined the 1999 film South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. That bit of nostalgia cut deep as the premiere mocked Trump over his global tariff proposals, the furor sounding the unreleased Epstein files, and the size of his penis. The White House responded with insults, as Parker and Stone surely hoped it would. The left's hypocrisy truly has no end. For years, they have come after South Park for what they labeled as offense content, but suddenly they're praising the show, a Trump spokesperson said in a statement to Variety. Just like the creators of South Park, the left has no authentic or original content, which is why their popularity continues to hit record lows. This show hasn't been relevant for over 20 years and is hanging by a thread with uninspired ideas in a desperate attempt for attention. Of course, the literal White House lashing out at a TV show does imply a certain degree of relevancy, but those clamoring for a swift encore did not get one. Last week, Comedy Central released a South Park teaser that both announced the season's second episode would not air until tonight and assured us that in it, Parker and Stone will not go any easier on Trump. The clip gave a brief glimpse of the show's Trump character feeling up Satan's thigh under a dining table. It's doubtful the White House enjoyed that either. Even so, on Tuesday, the Department of Homeland Security tried to reclaim the narrative by posting a still from tonight's episode that pictures an ICE raid alongside the link to join the federal agency. The official South Park X account replied, "Wait, so we are relevant?" before signing off with the hashtag eat a bag of dicks. Though a source familiar with the matter says the break was pre-planned, the week-long delay was surprising. South Park knows how to work fast, especially when reacting to new political intrigue. At the same time, it's never been an easy series to pin down. South Park initially made a name for itself with contrarian, pessimistic satire, arguably characterized by Stone saying back in 2001, "I hate conservatives, but I really fucking hate liberals." The Trump phenomenon challenged Parker and Stone to stake out a more evolved point of view, and a decade in, it seems as though they're still trying to figure it out. When asked to react to the buzzy premiere's fallout at a San Diego Comic-Con panel last month, Parker deadpanned, "We're terribly sorry." Such cheeky evasion has been his and Stone's defining quality as long as they've been making South Park. They want their stupid jokes and blatant provocations to speak for themselves, even when we're dying to know what the two of them really think. That's the original appeal and controversy of South Park, a portrait of filthy kids being filthy kids. In the 90s and early 2000s, schools banned students from wearing clothing that referenced the sitcom. Parents groups constantly spoke out against it. Debate swirled around the 1999 movie's rating, with the MPAA reportedly pushing for a prohibitive NC-17 label. It was ultimately rated R. South Park's fans have always loved how the show acts as a gleeful middle finger to authority, pummeling its way through different eras of American life. I'm going to pause briefly to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program, and we're in the middle of an article from VanityFair.com about South Park coming back on the air. Over the years, South Park has pissed off environmentalists for depicting Al Gore as a delusional climate activist, which they apologized for years later, and the Muslim community for a cartoon depiction of Muhammad, which Comedy Central ultimately censored. To inevitable outrage, white characters have said the N-word, straight characters have said the F-slur. The series considered President George W. Bush an incompetent moron and spoke out early against the post-September 11th U.S. response in the Middle East. It's laughed in the face of religious conservatism, often offending those groups most of all. Way back in 2005, a Virgin Mary statue started bleeding out her ass in an episode called Bloody Mary. It's also staked out surprising claims. More than a decade ago, the episode Sissy was hailed as a warm, forward-thinking unpacking of trans issues. Like he does with most things, Trump upended the show's balance. South Park's 19th season, which premiered in 2015, lampooned the rise of political correctness and safe spaces right alongside the rise of Trump, examining the dire state of polarization with a proudly heavy hand. Speaking with Vanity Fair 2 months before the 2016 election, Parker said he and Stone still weren't sure how they felt about PC culture. "I don't think we came to any real answers. And even back then, they sounded exhausted by the prospect of Trump as a subject. We already did this Donald Trump episode," Stone told Vanity Fair, "and real life is outrunning satire this year." When Trump stunned the country with his election night victory, the Emmy-winning sitcom pulled off a turnaround similarly remarkable to the season's premiere. But this time, it wasn't in the mood for jokes. Like a lot of people, Parker and Stone had assumed Hillary Clinton was about to become the first female president. The election's actual outcome left their ever-polarized fictional Colorado town in shock. It opens with a character bluntly remarking, "We learned that women can be anything, except for president." The episode was titled, "Oh, Geez." The tone was tentative, anxious, vulnerable, an earnest exemption to South Park's usual nihilism. During Trump's first term, South Park still appeared uncertain about how to handle him. The show called out the new president as a xenophobe and an authoritarian, jabbed at his wild behavior on Twitter, now X, and reminded viewers of the allegations of sexual assault that continued to trail him, and which Trump has denied. Yet perhaps because South Park filtered its Trump critique through the character of Mr. Garrison, he's been the show's stand-in for the president until this season. Trump ignored it. At the same time, Trump opponents criticized those same episodes, claiming they echoed alt-right sentiments, particularly when South Park tackled workplace harassment and trans athletes. Naturally, the right-leaning website The Daily Wire celebrated the episode about trans athletes as one of South Park's most unleashed writing. Pity the targets of the show's satirical cudgel. The show's 2014 episode about trans rights felt like a distant memory. South Park didn't even try to tackle the 2024 election. Last September, Parker and Stone told me that they had intentionally decided to skip it. "I don't know what more we could possibly say about Trump," Parker said. Clearly, over the intervening months, they changed their minds. With the Paramount situation forcing the longest break between new episodes in South Park's history, Parker and Stone had a lot of thoughts to unload. The creators did not respond to a request for comment. They're all bundled into Sermon on the Mount, a rapid response that feels like a return to form. But anyone in favor of the show's apparent progressive shift should know not to get too comfortable. South Park still mostly plays as an equal opportunity offender. It's the rare comedy to generate genuine, consistently strong reactions on both sides of the aisle. And regardless of where the praise and backlash falls, Parker and Stone's juvenile winkiness is still South Park's calling card. That's why their show can still pack a punch when it counts, but only when it has a personal itch to scratch, a score to settle, or a beam of satire to shoot straight from the gut. Parker and Stone depicted a vengeful U.S. president in bed with the devil while lambasting their own lightning rod of a network, then woke up the next day with smirks on their faces and the internet on fire, and all they had to say was, "Sorry." Nobody believes that endearingly adolescent lie, but we got the message all the same. Our next headline, Smithsonian minimizes Trump's double impeachment displays. The nation's museum whitewashed the language to describe the president's impeachments after being accused of promoting narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on August 9th. On Friday, the Smithsonian National Museum of American History removed some of the language used to explain President Donald Trump's historic two impeachments, softening the description amid the institution's ongoing review of its content to address increased scrutiny from the administration. Language referring to both impeachments from 2019 over his dealings with Ukraine and 2021 following the January 6th attack on the Capitol was altered. Previously, the display mentioned Trump's 2021 incitement charge being based on repeated false statements challenging the 2020 election results and giving a speech that encouraged and foreseeably resulted in imminent lawless action at the Capitol. Now the label reads, on January 13, 2021, Donald Trump became the first president to be impeached twice. The charge was incitement of insurrection based on his challenge of the 2020 election results and on his speech on January 6th. Because Trump's term ended in January 20th, he became the first former president tried by the Senate. He was acquitted on February 13, 2021. In the section that addresses Trump's first impeachment, the Smithsonian added the word alleged to the following line. The charges focused on the president's alleged solicitation of foreign interference in the 2020 presidential election and defiance of congressional subpoenas. The reworked language comes after the institution removed references to Trump's two impeachments from an exhibit display in late July, with the promise that the updated version was to come. The decision to remove the language was made by the Smithsonian's Board of Regents, the governing body of the institution. The group had committed to reviewing its content in response to pressure from the Trump administration. Trump, as the New York Times reports, has called for what he has described as a more positive framing from the country's history in Smithsonian museums. The administration's increased security of the Smithsonian's institution, a museum, education, and research complex of 21 museums, and the National Zoological Park, which saw almost 17 million visitors in 2024, has been happening for months. In March, Trump signed an executive order targeting the Smithsonian. The order, titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, accused the network of museums of being a part of a revisionist movement that seeks to undermine the remarkable achievements of the United States by casting its founding principles and historical milestones in a negative light. Once widely respected as a symbol of American excellence and a global icon of cultural achievements, the Smithsonian Institution has, in recent years, come under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology, the order reads. This shift has promoted narratives that portray Western and American values as inherently harmful and oppressive. The move called on Vice President J.D. Vance, who has a spot on the Smithsonian's board, along with the director of the Office of Management and Budget, to work with Congress to prohibit expenditures on exhibitions or programs that degrade shared American values, divide Americans by race, or promote ideologies inconsistent with federal law. The Smithsonian has held that it received no presidential instruction to remove the language about Trump's impeachment, and that the changes were made because the temporary display did not meet its usual presentational standards. In a statement on Friday, the institution also said that the temporary exhibit, put up in 2021, was blocking other items in the display, and that they had removed it to make way for a more permanent update to the content inside the case. At the heart of the Smithsonian's work is a steadfast commitment to scholarship, rigorous research, and the accurate factual presentation of history. The statement read, adhering to principles foundational to our role as the nation's museum, we take great care to ensure that what we represent to the public reflects both intellectual integrity and thoughtful design. The impeachment section at the museum isn't just about Trump. It's a part of an exhibit of the American presidency that opened at the Museum of American History 25 years ago. The section on the current and former presidents is displayed alongside information about the impeachments of former presidents Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton and the possible impeachment of former President Richard Nixon. Since Trump was elected, the Smithsonian has been at the epicenter of the administration's battle against inclusion in artistic institutions, as well as diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and how history museums tell the story of America. In May, Trump, via his social media platform Truth Social, claimed that he had fired Kim Sagitt, the director of the National Portrait Gallery, which is a part of the Smithsonian Network, calling her a highly partisan person and a strong supporter of DEI, which is totally inappropriate for her position. But he didn't have that power. The Smithsonian bylaws state that the president cannot fire the head of one of its museums. Still, in early June, Sagitt announced she would be stepping down from the position. Last month, the artist Amy Sherald, who rose to fame with her 2018 portrait of Michelle Obama, withdrew her upcoming solo show that was to be held at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery after she says she learned that the museum was considering removing a portrait of the trans model and performance artist Awa Bassett. In the piece, Bassett is depicted as the Statue of Liberty. The White House had decried the work, entitled Transforming Liberty, as an effort to reinterpret one of our nation's most sacred symbols through a divisive and ideological lens. Transforming Liberty, Sherald said of the painting, challenges who we allow to embody our national symbols and who we erase. The portrait, no longer headed to Washington, graced the cover of this week's New Yorker instead. Our next headline, Pete Hegseth reposts a video of his pastor criticizing a woman's right to vote. Doug Wilson, a self-described Christian nationalist, doesn't believe women should vote, serve in military combat, or be in church leadership. This is on August 10th. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reposted, with an endorsement, a video of pastors associated with his church saying that women shouldn't vote, sodomy should be illegal, again, across the nation, and that each town, each state, the nation, and the world ought to be Christian. All of Christ for all of life, Hegseth wrote on X. The CNN interview features Doug Wilson, a self-described Christian nationalist and senior pastor of Christ Church in Idaho, and other leaders describing their view of what America should look like. The church just opened a location in D.C., which held its inaugural service in a building owned by the Conservative Partnership Institute, a think tank co-led by President Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, according to CNN. Christianity Today reports that during a service several weeks ago, children in the pews whispered excitedly when Hegseth entered, and the defense secretary was mobbed by supporters as he left the church. The defense secretary, who is a parishioner, has previously praised Wilson, saying that the current generation is standing on the shoulders of leaders like him. In the CNN interview, reporter Pamela Brown asked Wilson, "Is planting a church in D.C. part of your plan to turn this into a Christian nation?" "Yes," he replied, noting earlier in the interview, "I'd like to see the town be a Christian town. I'd like to see the state be a Christian state. I'd like to see the nation be a Christian nation. I'd like to see the world be a Christian world." Brown asked Wilson a series of questions about his views on women in the church and public life. Wilson calls himself patriarchal, celebrated the Dobbs decision as a gift from God and Trump, has said voting should come from households, which men should typically run, and that women shouldn't hold any position of power in the church that involve exercising authority over men. Wilson, a veteran himself, believes that women shouldn't be in military combat. Secretary Hegseth has also said he's against women in combat roles. "Women," Wilson began in the CNN interview, "are the kind of people that people come out of." "So," Brown asked back, "you just think they're meant to have babies?" "It doesn't take any talent to simply reproduce biologically," Wilson replied. "The wife and mother, who is the chief executive of the home, is entrusted with 3 or 4 of 5 eternal souls." Brown then says that she is a working journalist and a mother of 3. "Good for you," he said. "Is that an issue for you?" she asked. "No, it's not automatically an issue," he replied. CNN also asked other pastors from the church if women should be allowed to vote. Toby Sumter, a senior pastor, said that in his ideal society, we would vote as households, and I would ordinarily be the one to cast the vote, he said, but I would cast the vote having discussed it with my household. Jared Longshore, another pastor, said he would support repealing the 19th Amendment. CNN also spoke with Josh and Amy Prince, a married couple who moved with their children to attend the church. Brown asked Josh if he saw Amy as his equal. "Yes and no," he replied. "Yes," he explained, "in that they are both saved by God. And no," he clarified, "because they have different God-given purposes. He is the head of our household," Amy said, "and I do submit to him." Elsewhere in the interview, Wilson reiterated some other talking points. While he thinks slavery wasn't biblical, there were some decent human beings who were enslavers, and that America should go back several decades to when sodomy was illegal in all 50 states. Hegseth didn't repost the CNN link to the interview. Instead, he reshared the video from Canon Press, a publishing house located in Moscow, Idaho, that is connected to Christ Church. Canon Press, which sells books written by the Wilson family, merchandise, Christian homeschooling materials, and more, described itself as a Christian publisher with a sense of humor that sometimes gets us into trouble, but their website notes, we like it that way. Canon Press has currently hosted a CNN sale until Monday evening, featuring books like It's Good to Be a Man, The Case for Christian Nationalism, Same-Sex Mirage, Phantasmagoria at the Altar, and some biblical responses, Building Her House, Commonsensical Wisdom for Christian Women, and The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity. The books above are the ones CNN doesn't want you to read, the sale page says. Hegseth's post, All of Christ for All of Life, is also the name of a Canon Press podcast, with episode titles like Should Women Work Outside the Home? And Better Personnel Equals More Trump Wins. The defense secretary has also come under fire for his views on women in the military and his alleged treatment of women. On women in service, he wrote in his book that women cannot physically meet the same standards as men and that dads push us to take risks. Moms put the training wheels on our bikes. We need moms, but not in the military, especially in combat units. Hegseth, according to himself and his lawyer, paid a woman $50,000 in a confidential financial settlement after she accused him of sexual assault. In a 2018 email she now says she regrets, Hegseth's mother, Penelope, wrote that her son belittles, lies, cheats, sleeps around, and uses women for his own power and ego. Currently, Hegseth is the most high-profile Trump administration member who attends Wilson's church and has, since taking office, imbued his form of Christianity into his personal life. In May, in what he hopes will become a monthly tradition, Hegseth led a Christian prayer service in the Pentagon's auditorium. At the event, which was during working hours, Trump was praised as a divinely appointed leader. In the CNN interview, Wilson said that the prayer service is not organizationally tied to his congregation, but he noted, it's the kind of thing we love to see. Let's hear from Bess Levin. What's going on with Marjorie Taylor Greene? The congresswoman from Georgia has split with Donald Trump and the MAGA faithful on a number of issues over the last few months. In a new interview, she said she doesn't want anything to do with the current Republican Party. This is on August 4th. Marjorie Taylor Greene has long been known for her rabid loyalty to Donald Trump and his MAGA agenda, to the extent that it would not be surprising if she were to throw a drink in someone's face for, say, expressing skepticism over the president's long-promised border wall. During her nearly 5 years in Congress, their Georgia representative has joked that January 6 would have been successful had she organized it, demonized transgender people, lobbed Islamophobic attacks, and embraced the most batshit of conspiracy theories, aka Trump's bread and butter. If Politico were to report that she was planning to show up to Trump's State of the Union address with an American flag painted on her face and the words, Biological Ladies for Trump, written across her chest, people would be like, yeah, that checks out. Yet lately, Greene has been engaging in some extremely unexpected behavior. She's broken with Trump and Team MAGA on numerous issues, and quite vocally at that. In early June, for example, she took to X to criticize the Big Beautiful Bill, writing that if she had actually read the full text of Trump's signature legislation, she would have voted no. Like all but two House Republicans, she ultimately voted to pass the version that became law. A couple of weeks later, she went to bat for Tucker Carlson after Trump lashed out at the former Fox News host for saying the U.S. should not support Israel's attacks on Iran. Following a Truth Social post in which the president called Carlson kooky and said someone should tell him Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, Greene took to X to tell her followers, Tucker Carlson unapologetically believes the same things I do, that if we don't fight for our country and our own people, then we will no longer have a country for our children and our grandchildren. And foreign wars, intervention, regime change put America last, kill innocent people, are making us broke, and will ultimately lead to our destruction. That's not kooky. That's what millions of Americans voted for. It's what we believe is America first. Greene's defense of Carlson came one day after she loudly declared that everyone is finding out who are real America First, MAGA, and who were fake, adding that anyone slobbering for the U.S. to become fully involved in the Israel-Iran war is not America First/MAGA. a claim appearing to suggest that Trump himself, given his take on the situation, was not a real MAGA guy. After Trump's Justice Department announced no further information about disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein would be released, and that there was no evidence to charge anyone else in connection with his crimes, Green said in an interview, "It's a full reversal on what was all said beforehand, and people are just not willing to accept it." Later, without mentioning Epstein by name, she wrote on X, "If you tell the base of people who support you of deep state treasonous crimes, election interference, blackmail, and rich powerful elite evil cabals, then you must take down every enemy of the people. If not, the base will turn and there's no going back. Dangling bits of red meat no longer satisfies. They want the whole steak dinner and will accept nothing else." To be clear, it does not appear that the Congresswoman, who is a huge fan of conspiracy theories, was suggesting that Trump and company should stop fanning the flames of such things, but rather they should follow through on their pledges to expose them. More recently, Green said that Israel is committing genocide, that the situation in Gaza is absolutely unacceptable, and that America should stop providing military aid to Israel. She also insisted that no American should face persecution of any kind because of their identity, including Muslim Americans, a pretty shocking statement from a woman who once claimed practicing Muslims who believe in Sharia law should not be allowed to serve in government. Speaking of Muslim Americans, Green praised Zohan Mamdani's mayoral primary campaign, calling it unique and very smart, whereas Trump is focused on threats to arrest the Democratic nominee to lead New York City. Then, in an interview published by the Daily Mail over the weekend, Green went so far as to suggest that there could be a world in which she leaves the Republican Party, saying, "I don't know if the Republican Party is leaving me or if I'm kind of not relating to the Republican Party as much anymore. I don't know which one it is." While reiterating her full loyalty to Trump, she declared, "The Republican Party has turned its back on America First and the workers and just regular Americans," adding of the GOP, "The course that it's on, I don't want to have anything to do with it, and I just don't care anymore." In the same interview, Green said she believes Republican women are in touch with what conservative voters want, while the good old boys of the party are not. "I think there's other women in our party that are really sick and tired of the way men treat Republican women," she said, adding that she thinks Representative Elise Stefanik, who was nominated by Trump to serve as UN ambassador, and then had her nomination pulled by the White House to protect the GOP majority in the House, got shafted. Green continued to speak about Stefanik. "I mean, she got screwed by House Speaker Mike Johnson, and she got screwed by the White House. I'm not blaming Trump particularly, I'm blaming the people in the White House." She then expressed disbelief that former National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who lost his gig after mistakenly including a journalist in a Signal group chat that featured discussion of confidential military plans, was subsequently nominated for the UN spot. "How does he get awarded after Signalgate? Isn't that weird?" Green wondered aloud, almost sounding like a rational person. To be clear, no one should take Green's comments and surprising new policy positions to mean that she's undergone a personality transplant and isn't still the person who once suggested that California wildfires were started by a Jewish space laser. In the same Daily Mail conversation, she talked about a desire to keep using Elon Musk's Doge to take a sledgehammer to the federal government, and she recently introduced a bill predicated on conspiracy theories about the weather. She's also continued to demonize immigrants, including those coming to the country legally, defended Vladimir Putin, and voted to defund NPR and PBS. But her willingness to break with Trump on issues close to the president's heart is curious. Has she read the writing on the wall regarding Republicans' chances in the midterm elections and said, "Screw it"? She recently announced she won't be running for Georgia governor or Senate, so it's not clear what her ambitions are. Is she simply choosing to speak her mind and occasionally say things that sound reasonable while still maintaining her unique brand of "what the fuck, lady"? Only time will tell. Our next Levin report, if you threaten to fire him, you blow up the company. The catch-22 of Elon's $29 billion Tesla payday. This is on August 6th. By now, you've likely heard the news that Tesla has awarded Elon Musk 96 million shares of the company, valued at $29 billion. Despite his foray into politics contributing to a 25% drop in the company's stock price, Despite his market-moving feud with the president, despite his intention to start a new political party, which has also impacted the stock, and not in a good way. Now, you might be thinking, wait, if everything Musk has done lately has been bad for Tesla, why is the board making him nearly $30 billion richer, as opposed to showing him the door, as would typically be the case in corporate America? The point of view of Tesla investors is that they just don't have a choice. Max Chafkin, co-host of the Elon Inc. podcast, tells Vanity Fair, "You can't threaten to fire him, because if you threaten to fire him, you blow up the company." Which means the people with a vested interest in Tesla's stock going up have to instead hope that the shares Musk was awarded this week, which he can access after 2 years, will convince him to spend less time on politics and more time on his actual job. In a letter to shareholders, board members Robin Denholm and Kathleen Wilson-Thompson wrote of the package, "We know that one of your top concerns is keeping Elon's energies focused on Tesla," adding that the stock grant was a critical first step toward achieving that goal. Incredibly, the award package does not require Musk to meet any performance goals. It simply requires him to remain in a senior leadership role at the company for 2 years, which should be straightforward enough. Though, when one is talking about a guy whose hobbies include running his own personal sperm bank, nothing is straightforward. As for whether the nearly $30 billion will actually keep Elon's energies focused on Tesla, that remains an open question. While the award represents an astronomical sum to 99.99999% of the population, Musk was already the richest person in the world. This is not a situation of like your average white-collar worker being all, "Ugh, I really want to quit my job, but I can't until I get my bonus next year." On the other hand, increasing Musk's paper net worth makes his empire more stable, Chafkin says. In addition to Tesla, Musk's business empire includes, among other things, space technology company SpaceX, neurotechnology startup Neuralink, infrastructure firm The Boring Company, and X, nay, Twitter. It's really important when you think about Musk. There are his separate companies, but they're interlocked, and the thing that's tying them together is Elon Musk, Chafkin notes. It's not like he's going to buy a bigger house. By his own account, the reason he wants to make all this money is because he wants to take humanity to Mars, and $30 billion is going to make a difference. $30 billion is $30 billion. Still, Chafkin says, the idea that he's going to leave politics is just fanciful. He is inherently political. He's still, on any given day, tweeting about politics. Recent posts have included calling the Treasury Secretary a Soros stooge and asking, how can people be expected to have faith in Trump if he won't release the Epstein files? As for Musk's new political party, which he said he would form after polling his social media followers, according to a new report from Axios, Musk apparently hasn't taken visible steps to make formal filings for the America Party. And once frenetic whispers from third-party consultants about working for him have gone radio silent, but he has not turned off the money spigot, according to Politico. Musk gave $15 million in donations to super PACs supporting Trump and the GOP in June after he said he'd done enough political spending. Still, Chafkin tells me there's a question of how he's going to participate. From the point of view of the Tesla board, it would be better if he didn't have a feud with Donald Trump, but I don't think the stock grant resolves that. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.